Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to Crime, Lime, and Vodka. We're a newly established podcast, which is made up of a bartender and a hairdresser who likes to unwind with a cocktail and a crime case. We'll contain violent descriptions and streams of details following the murder cases. Here's to make a difference in the only way that we know how. Thanks for tuning in to Crime, Lime, and Vodka. Hey guys, welcome to Crime, Lime, and Vodka. I'm Tracy.
And I'm Amber.
And today, our first episode, we will be telling the story of the notorious Gary Heidnik, who was more than just the creepy guy next door. He was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1943. His parents divorced when he was 4 years old, leaving him and his younger brother to decide who to live with. His mother suffered from a severe mental illness and couldn't really cope with life, let alone take care of her two boys. So they soon moved in with their father and his new wife. He was teased in school for apparently falling out of a tree, hitting his head, and it caused it to be misshapen. So he'd go to school, get teased, come home, have his father shame on him, and make him throw his soiled sheets over the balcony for the whole neighborhood to see. He was a chronic bedwetter, and his father resented it. He was emotionally abused as well as verbally. Later on, after Gary's arrest, his father denies the abuse, but who would admit to abusing their child? Soon as his life progressed, his hatred for people grew. He couldn't form connections with people, including his family. He had a really hard time communicating with people. It was almost as if he couldn't feel anything. At the age of 14, he pretty much hated school. He never attended. School was not for him, and he dropped out. He joined Staunton Military Academy. He got to the point where he would wear only his military attire around the house. He would never take it off. So he's pretty obsessed with the whole mind control thing. So soon after graduating from the military academy at 17, he went straight into the army. He only served for 13 months when he fell sick. He got super nauseous, dizzy, having migraines. Something was wrong and he couldn't take it. So this is now in the late 60s. People really didn't know anything about mental illness, let alone how to help people who had it. So in the military, it was very crucial that you were 100%. From flat foot to schizophrenia, if you had any of it, they would discharge you. So following the exam, he was diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder.
So what is the difference between schizoid personality disorder and schizophrenia?
Well, schizophrenia comes with the hallucinations, the paranoia, involved with the also like super depressive episodes. And when you have schizoid personality disorder, it's more of a personality disorder. You can't connect with people. You can't have any emotional connection with people, but you still have the paranoia looped in. So you still have the symptoms, but it's not like hallucinating full on 100%. So he couldn't really live in society and be able to connect with others. He had a disattachment where he just couldn't help it. If you're treated right with the illness, you can live as normal as you can with an illness. But like, it all started to make sense. His life started to get a little bit better when he got put on his medicine. But he was granted honorable discharge and was released. He had to get a job. He had to make a living. He was ranking in $1,300 a month in disability. So that was a lot back then because he was a veteran. But like now on disability, you make maybe $700-$800. So he was already making a good chunk of change back in the day, but he didn't want to really struggle. So he got a job as a psych nurse at a Veterans Administration. But he was soon fired because he had a really rude behavior with patients and he was never there. He never showed up to work. So they let him go. In the fall of 1970, Gary's mother succeeded in her last suicide attempt by mercury poisoning. Nothing about her death really did anything to him. He didn't really have a connection with his family, and it was the last straw. He decided to move away. So he ends up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I feel like Gary took a sense of godliness in himself. He saw himself above people to a point where he was all they needed in his mind. He was like their god. In the fall of 71, he founded a church. He kind of felt like it called to him, which is another thing that happens when you have schizophrenia a lot of the time. People feel like they're a god. So that's why a lot of people who started cults, they had a mental illness. Like, your mind just tells you things. That's crazy. He named it the United Church of Ministers of God. He found a way to skip out on taxes. So in government's eyes, a church is also seen as a charity. So you don't get taxed on it. He made a very small investment of just $3,500 in his church. And he ended up quadrupling that in income from the tithes. Most of his church followers made up of the mentally disabled people that he would meet at the Elwin Institution. He was seen as a very intelligent man. He had the IQ of 148, and he seen himself as a superior. His fascination with being in control grew, and it grew even more as he seen his growth and success. He invested some of his money into the stock market, and he ended up making $500,000. Off the stock market.
Holy crap.
So now he's really feeling himself. He would like show off all his money. He would buy a luxury home, a few nice cars, and a junky boat. He would hold his Bible studies at his house every Wednesday. And I guess all the traffic on top of him being such a hoarder, his neighbors would really complain about him. Like, he was the neighbor that nobody wanted to live by. And he took that very seriously. He had a tenant that lived with him. And he would run out of room, and he really thought that this guy had it out for him. He thought that his tenant was the one that was complaining. He ended up getting a note that he was going to get evicted from the suburb. So, like, in kind of rich suburbs, you are kind of told rules about your house, and if you don't abide by them, they kind of kick you out the neighborhood. So he was about to get kicked out the neighborhood. So he confronted his tenant, and he was like, look, somebody's complaining about me. And I really think it's you. The guy was clueless. He really didn't understand. And Gary really didn't care. So he shot the man in the face. It didn't kill him, but he was still charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. The guy, I guess he just really didn't want to have anything to do with the case anymore. He wanted to just drop it. And the charges were dropped, and Gary left the home. This was his first run-in with the law. So he decided to just get out of town, get a fresh start. And he picks up and moves to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He buys his last home, a new Rolls Royce, and a nice Cadillac DeVille, a van that was targeting his church that he kind of had as a billboard with his face on it.
Gary was definitely letting the money show. He couldn't find a connection with a woman when it didn't involve him being forceful. In 1978, he meets Anjanette Davidson. She was a mentally disabled Black woman, 34 years old, but with the mind of a toddler. They end up having a daughter named Maxine, but she was taken by CPS shortly after her birth. Now, this is around the time he got out of control, and he was becoming forceful with the women in his life. So they drive up to Harrisburg to sign out Anjanette's mentally retarded sister, Alberta. Now, they would normally only allow like a lunch date, but you know Gary decides to keep her. So they drive back to his house. He shackles her to the water pipes and beats her, rapes her every day. I mean, this guy has no boundaries. The institution figured out that she was missing and saw that Gary signed her out. They track her down and find her at Gary's house in his basement, shackled to a water pipe, covered in filth, beaten, and broken. She was taken to the hospital where they found she contracted gonorrhea from him.
Wow.
He was arrested and sentenced 3 to 7 years in prison. Tell me why he only served 4 years and 4 months and was released to a psych ward.
Well, he actually had attempted suicide while he was in jail that first time, which seems like a very normal thing for him and his family.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's horrible. So in 1983, he joined a mail order bride website, began writing with a 22-year-old Betty Disto for 2 years until she decided to move to the United States and marry him in 1985. Now, it didn't take long for Gary's true colors to show. He almost immediately would bring multiple women home to have sex with. And he would even do it in front of her. When she didn't like it, he began raping her too and making her join in their sexual activities. So she ended up pregnant with their son, Jesse, in January of 86. She decided she couldn't take it no more, so she left him, went to a shelter for battered women, and told the advisor about her abuse. Now, they called the police immediately and filed a report, and he was once again arrested. But Betty never showed up to the court date, causing the charges to be dropped again, slipping through police fingers yet again.
It's became a pattern with him to just get away with it.
Right. So it didn't take long for him to get back out there. He was on the prowl for his next prey. Josefina Rivera was the perfect type. She was a 26-year-old mom of three, a young black prostitute just trying to get by. Days before Thanksgiving, Josefina looked in her fridge, didn't have no food, no money. She wanted to feed her kids for Thanksgiving and basically have a normal holiday. So Josefina decided to hit the streets. While she was walking, she seen Gary pull up in a nice white Cadillac DeVille. They talk money and she gets in the car. Now, normally, Josefina did not go home with the men. She did her business in the car. She got out. I guess this was a safer way to do business back then.
I mean, if you're in the car, you're in like a territory where you can get out rather than in a house, you know?
Yeah, I get it. But this time was different. Josefina really needed the money, so Gary talks her into coming back to the house. So they go to the house, go upstairs, they do the promise, and as Josefina is putting on her clothes to leave, Gary comes up behind her and starts choking her, and basically until she's unconscious, or almost unconscious, he drags her to his basement, handcuffed her wrists and ankles, shackling her to an exposed water pipe. Next thing Josefina remembers is being in a 4x4 hole with a plywood top, barely enough room to move. He would cover it with sandbags to keep her from escaping. She was the first, but not the last. He would rape her daily. Her diet consists of water, soggy bread. When she was good, he would give her dog treats. He treated her worse than an animal. But it didn't take long for him to get bored and need another one. So on December 3rd, 1986, he picks up his next victim, 25-year-old Sandra Lindsay. She was a mutual friend to Gary's handyman, Cyril Brown, who was, you guessed, also a mentally disabled person. Next, he found 19-year-old Lisa Thomas. She was neither a mentally disabled person or a sex worker. He just seen her. He asked her to dinner and to buy her a new outfit. She seen he had a nice Rolls Royce, and why would she say no? She said yeah. So he kidnapped her 2 days after Christmas of 86. January 2nd, 1987, he kidnapped Deborah Dudley. She was a fighter and did not give up. He would make the other girls take part in beating each other, and she would always fall victim to the harshness because she just didn't give up. She always gave him shit. On January 18th, 1987, he kidnapped Jacqueline Askins, an 18-year-old black woman who was more of the quiet one. He spoke of his plan of having a large family. He gave these women positions as his wives.
So he was basically trying to pull off like the Mormon thing.
Right, but locking them up instead.
Oh yeah, that's definitely way worse.
So he wanted up to 10 women to multiply his kids with. His goal was to have as many as possible. He wanted to be like Adam, create his own following. Soon, the women would beat on Deb not to get beaten themselves that day. From 8 to 8 at night, they would all be jammed in one hole together, side by side. Now, this is a 4x4 foot hole, covered with a wooden plank, sandbags on top. That's a tight fit.
It it's definitely...
That's a lot of women.
Yeah. And, I mean, they're already tiny because of their diet.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they had no room to breathe.
Right. So, one day, Sandra got caught trying to move the wooden plank to free herself. Gary took her by her wrist, hung her from the water pipes exposed on the ceiling, and days passed, and Sandra still held on. The girls began to beg Gary to let her down, just to give her a break. Sandra had a bad jaw, she couldn't chew correctly, and he would try to shove food in her mouth and make her swallow, because Gary didn't know she had a bad jaw. He just kidnapped her. So, when she started to choke, and he finally went to go get the keys to unlock the handcuffs to let her down, she falls to the ground instantly. As soon as she hits the ground, they knew she was gone. So Gary, being the great guy, he makes the other victims carry Sandra's body upstairs and help him dismember her. He uses this as an act to make them fear him more, like he had something against them if they ran away. He would say, "Will you help me cut up this body?" So after the girls returned to the basement, he roasted Sandra's ribs in the oven, boiled her head on the stove.
Can you imagine being downstairs and he's boiling your friend that you have lived in this captivity with upstairs?
Mm-mm. He used that is gross. That's gross. So imaginably, you would think it stinks, right? Well, the neighbors call the cops. And the cops come over to his house, ask him what's that smell. He says, "I burnt a roast. I fell asleep. I just burnt a roast." So that's it. The police just leave. And he grinds up Sandra's ribs, mixes it with dog food, and feeds it to the girls. He wraps up her limbs, labels it as dog food, and stores it in the freezer. Gary started to get more paranoid by the minute. He would chain the women up, jam screwdrivers into their ears so they could not plot against him, or like hear when he had church sermons going on and yell for help. When he would leave one woman in charge, and when he come back, he'd ask that one person, "How were the girls?" And if she said bad, he would beat the other women. If she said good, he would beat her.
So there was a bad result regardless when he left.
Yeah. So Josephina was known as maybe an accomplice at one point for the fact that she helped him. She had convinced him that she loved him. She was the first girl. So she knew her way of getting out and what she thought was how to get out of the situation. So she didn't fight him when he fought her. She soon became his favorite. So he found a new torture system. He would have the women chained in a hole and have Josephina fill the hole partially with water and electrocute them. Now, unfortunately, Deborah was the first victim to this. He put her in the hole. Josephina put water in it. They electrocuted her, and immediately she dies. And that was on March 22nd, 1987. He had Josephina help him dispose of the body in a state forest in New Jersey.
So you're basically saying he wanted his 10 wives, but he kept killing them, so he had to go shop for a new one.
Basically.
His new victim that Josephina helped kidnap was 18-year-old Agnes. They only had her for 2 days. She endured the least amount of abuse. She was kidnapped on March 24th, and the next day, Josephina finally convinced Gary to let her say goodbye to her family. She was using this as a way to show that she was really going to be there with him forever. So he parks at a gas station about a block away from her apartment she shared with her boyfriend. Gary gave her 15 minutes to say goodbye. He had told her that if she didn't return in time, he was threatening to kill the other girls. So she walked with speed. She had a limited time to work out her plan. She tells her boyfriend frantically about the abuse. He didn't really believe her at first. He was like, "You left me here to take care of the kids by myself. like, you just left. And she's like, no, I didn't. I was kidnapped. So once she shows him the wounds on her wrists and ankles, they run down the street to the nearest payphone and they call the police. The police rush out because they have to take statements like that seriously. And they come out and they're looking for Gary at the gas station. They approach his Cadillac and ask him to come with them. The first thing he says, is this about the missed child support?
Are you kidding me?
Nothing about the woman that he left at his house in his basement. He was taken into custody for questioning while the police go back to his house and see if the other women are really there. As they enter his basement of hell, they spot the remaining women, naked from the waist down, chained to exposed water pipes, suffering. They all were rescued except Deborah and Sandra. On March 26, 1987, he was charged with 6 counts of kidnapping, numerous charges of rape, and 2 first-degree murders of Sandra and Deborah. He was held on a $4 million bond, and Cyril Brown was arrested as an accomplice. They ended up releasing him on a $50,000 bond, only if he complied with testifying against Gary. In April of 87, he attempted suicide yet again. He failed and was placed under suicide watch. The defense attorney tried to convince the jury that he was incompetent to stand trial. They used the LSD experiment in the military as a reasoning for his insanity. They failed to prove it, and he was convicted of 2 first-degree murders and sentenced to death. His ex-wife Betty and daughter Maxine tried to place an appeal to have a stay of execution based off of him being insane in 1997, but was determined that he came up with the money from the stock market and he was competent. On July 6, 1999, he picked his last meal of 2 slices of pizza and 2 cups of coffee. Then he was executed by lethal injection and soon cremated, and no one claimed his remains.
So his last meal was just 2 slices of pizza and 2 cups of coffee?
You know, sometimes that's people's favorite food. Like, I want margaritas and tacos.
I would want my last meal to be gumbo and a nice glass of sweet tea.
You're such a Southern.
So, thanks for tuning in, you guys, to our very first episode of Crime, Lime, and Vodka. Be on the lookout for our upcoming episodes.
Today in our day-to-day life, it is so dangerous to be a young woman. It's terrifying seeing the amount of women murdered and kidnapped every day. Right now, we have 239,487 missing women under the age of 25 in the United States. We have to work together to save each other. If you feel uncomfortable about it, your instinct is right. Never go against your own judgment. Sometimes it could just save your life.